This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This week, as new reports on abuses at Abu Ghraib raise more questions about the military's interrogation practices, we're joined by Sergeant First Class Chris Mackey. Chris Mackey is a senior interrogator in the U.S. Army Reserves. He's written a book about his experiences after September 11th, questioning prisoners in Afghanistan. Together with Greg Miller, the national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, Chris Mackey detailed the ethical and political dilemmas interrogators face in their work. Tonight on Point, a U.S. Army interrogator on his time in Afghanistan and the line between fair tactics and abuse. What techniques are appropriate when the security stakes are high? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from France is Chris Mackey. He served as a sergeant and senior interrogator with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan just after September 11th. Mackey is co-author of the book, The Interrogators. Good evening, Chris.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And from Washington, we're joined by his co-author, Greg Miller, the national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome, Greg.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Before we get to the book, there's news out of Washington today on the intelligence front. Greg Miller, you've reported that President Bush issued an order today to increase the power of the Central Intelligence Agency. What is going to change in the intelligence structure?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the White House sort of described this as a down payment on further changes to come. What Bush did today was sign executive orders that bolster the authority of the director of the CIA. And as the White House basically said, they gave this person as much authority as they could by executive order, which it doesn't mean necessarily a whole lot. And he will have a little more authority over the budgets over the various agencies, and it'll be clearer that he is in charge of coordinating the activities of the various agencies. But obviously many lawmakers in Congress and even the White House acknowledge that more reforms are to come. There'll be the creation of a national intelligence director, and Congress will be involved in passing legislation to make those changes.
Well, I'm a little confused here. I mean, when you expand the job of the CIA director, his job is not being expanded into the national intelligence director?
He'll be on an interim basis, is okay. My understanding. Will be serving as sort of the national intelligence director, which is what the September 11 Commission, that was its principal recommendation.
Right.
The country needs somebody who is clearly in charge of the nation's 15 intelligence agencies. So the Bush administration, eager to be seen as in charge on this issue, is taking an interim step here, elevating the authority of the CIA director, but also indicating that they're going to be working with Congress to create a new position, a national intelligence director position, that would be separate from the CIA director later on.
Okay, got you. Let's move to the book. And I have lots of questions for you, Chris Mackey. You went to Afghanistan with years of training in interrogations. And I'm curious, looking back, do you feel that you were ready to face an Al-Qaeda terrorist across the table when you landed in Afghanistan?
Well, the training that we received was very, very good, and it was a great foundation. But I don't think that the Army could possibly have anticipated every opponent that we would have faced as interrogators or as infantrymen or artillerymen or whatever. And so I think by the time we got there, we realized that we were not fully prepared to engage the enemy that we were set to oppose.
Go ahead.
But we were able eventually, I think, to come up with our own sort of ad hoc measures to increase our proficiency. And by the time we left, we were pretty good at what we were doing.
What was it about your initial approach that wasn't working for you in Bagram, Afghanistan?
Well, the training that we received when we went through Fort Huachuca in Arizona, which is where all Army interrogators go to receive their initial training, anticipated an enemy that would probably cooperate with us 95% of the time and asking him direct questions. that 5% of the prisoners that we would encounter would require an approach, as we call it. But in fact, when we got to Afghanistan, we realized that those percentages were almost directly reversed.
95% of the people didn't want to help you at all, and 5% were cooperating. So what did you do? You mentioned in the book that you started off very much by the book, but your approach got a lot more hard-edged as time went on. What did you change?
Well, I think the interrogations that we anticipated in our training basically envisioned an opponent that was going to cooperate and fight by the Geneva Conventions themselves, and that we envisioned an enemy that would be, you know, sort of you'd be able to dissect by ethnicity. So you'd be able to find the Ukrainian among the Russians, and you'd be able to get him, the person who did not have the Commissol card, that was part of the party member, and you'd be able to persuade that person to cooperate with you by incenting him, usually through positive things. For example, you know, hey, would you like to move to Coney Island? But, you know, I can do that for you. And, you know, at the end of the war, you can find yourself living in Brooklyn. But, you know, the opponents that we were facing in Afghanistan had absolutely no interest in what we might be able to offer them. Positive incentives were not part of the game, and so we needed to adjust our interrogation techniques to involve some negative incentives, if you will.
Well, what, speaking of negative incentives, tell us what monstering is.
Well, monstering was sort of our flirtation with the idea of sleep deprivation. Of course, this is the early stages of the war on terrorism, and there weren't a lot of well-evolved ideas about how we were going to be facing our opponents and how we were going to be directing our efforts and what types of approaches were appropriate. But what we realized was, by the time that we had been there for quite a few months, that the best information that we were getting from prisoners was coming at the end of long interrogations.
Mm.
So what we did was we realized that we could not really have sleep deprivation, because in our, you know, sort of innocent in those days, sort of an unintentionally enlightened interpretation of the rules, we thought that we couldn't engage in direct sleep deprivation, but we thought what we could do was set a single interrogator against a single prisoner for as long as the interrogator could go. As long as both people had breaks at the same time, we thought that we would be immune from all but the sort of the most unrealistic criticism. And it worked. We probably only did it 14 or 15 times while we were there, the entire 10 months or 9 months that I was in Afghanistan, but in monstering. But the approach did work, and it did provide the best information that we got while we were there.
I'd like to hear a little more about what you just said there about in your initial innocent approach. You feel you abided by the Geneva Convention in all your interrogations?
I know that we abided by the Geneva Conventions, and we everything that we did. I mean, we were absolutely obsessed with the Geneva Conventions while I was there, because we thought that the, you know, punishment would be swift if we didn't, and if that wasn't enough, the people that were there were, you know, very, very ethical people. We just didn't want to. We didn't think that we could do that and get away with it, not just because it was against the rules, but because it was wrong.
And yet, what did you find out later about what the rules were for you that you didn't know at the time?
Well, what I found out since then, I mean, through the newspaper, is that the Army envisioned a set of rules that apparently, you know, hopefully very smart people, but it seems like they were wrong, thought that we were, you know, we were obviously not going as far as they've allowed subsequent interrogators and subsequent campaigns to go.
You mentioned in the book a specific memo that that had on the left-hand side all of the sort of more standard approaches that you were used to, and then on the right-hand side, a whole bunch of ideas that interrogators could pursue with the approval of a commander. Did you know that those were even options for you at the time?
I believe that those things evolved. That
yeah.
That interrogators had a set of instructions that were more sophisticated by the time people got to Iraq, for example, and I think that even by the time that a few months after I left Afghanistan, that they had reached a level of sophistication that everything was sort of codified. I do know that, of course, I know about this mainly through newspaper reports and through my friends who are still in the service and who are still fighting in Iraq or elsewhere. And those second set of rules came about because the first set of rules are not especially effective against the enemy that we're facing. so they, you know, the command eventually, and I don't know how high up this went, but someone decided that they needed to empower interrogators to do more things, I suppose.
Now, I want to make clear for the listener the sort of time frame involved for you here, and the time frame that you cover in the book. The things that we're reading about in the newspapers, the atrocities and some of the mysteries, happened after you left Afghanistan. I'm thinking there of the two prisoners who died in custody in Bagram, and of course everything that was done in Abu Ghraib was after your tenure there. What do you think happened between your tour and all of these incidents that we're now discussing?
Well, I will say that I have seen reports from Amnesty International elsewhere, which do take place in the time frame when I was in Bagram. I mean, it's nothing on, it doesn't appear anyway superficially to be on the scale of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But some prisoners are making allegations that are not completely divorced from what's happened elsewhere. And all I can tell you is that we never would have allowed that on our watch. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but in my process of due diligence, while I was there, we would not have countenanced that kind of behavior. And I did everything that I could and didn't need to do very much, because the interrogators that I worked with, the six or seven interrogators that we had there, were just superb soldiers. But I don't know what happened in Iraq, although I can hypothesize. I think that what happens in a campaign where there are a lot of casualties, that the entire environment changes. And I'm guessing, but I suppose that when battlefield commanders start putting pressure on soldiers because of the fact that they know that the people that they've turned over have information about a roadside bomb or about a pending attack or an ambush, I think that the dimensions change. And while I'm not countenancing what happened in Iraq or what happened subsequent to my departure in Afghanistan, I can understand. At least I can have the acumen to accept that that's a possibility, that interrogators could come under that kind of pressure. I would like to hope that their training, which is directed for this very incident, and it covers a lot of circumstances where you might be faced with this or confronted with this kind of situation. I would like to think that they had been trained well enough to resist that kind of temptation, but it doesn't sound like that was always the case.
Can I add one thing?
Yes, I was just about to say, Greg Miller.
You heard Chris talking a moment ago about monstering and explaining that was sort of where they ended up at the end of their time there. They came up with a rationale for using that version of sleep deprivation under sort of tight restrictions. But what happens is when Chris and his unit leave, they're replaced by another unit. And for them, that's sort of where Chris and his unit, their ending point is the starting point for those that follow.
Okay.
And the unit that follows is the one that's in place. The 519th is the one that's in place in December when two prisoners die. And it's also a unit that is highly represented at Abu Ghraib, as it turns out. And the other thing I would say is that, one thing that's interesting to me is that Chris and his colleagues were left largely to sort of sort these issues out on their own. They were not getting a lot of top-down direction, let alone, seeing memos from the Pentagon or from CENTCOM or something like that spelling out interrogation policy.
Mm.
But while Chris and his unit are grappling with this, it simultaneously, they're completely unaware of it, but simultaneously, there are memos flying back and forth between the Justice Department and the CIA and the Pentagon in Washington as, lawyers and other senior officials in Washington are grappling with these issues and coming up with very different answers. They're really trying to come up with arguments for how aggressive can we possibly interpret these Geneva Conventions and other restrictions.
I'm interested in what got you involved in the book, Greg. Was this as a response to Abu Ghraib, or were you and Chris Mackey working on this long before any of that came to light?
We were working on it long before any of it arrived. In fact, we had to sort of rush at the end to address Abu Ghraib because it came up just about when our book was just about ready to go to press. That story started to break. The book started. Chris and I met in Afghanistan. I went there for my paper and was granted access to Chris and a number of other interrogators, and came back and did a story about the interrogation unit at Bagram, and then Chris and I kept in touch, and I always thought it would be a terrific book, but didn't see how it could be done unless there was somebody inside who wanted to tell their story, and And Chris later approached me and suggested that he was interested in doing that. And so we collaborated and came up with a proposal, and we were on our way.
And how long did it take you to do?
I think it was about a year.
You mentioned in the book, actually, Chris, that there was a lot done that in the preparation for the book that you needed to do just to make sure that you got your facts right, because it was such a crazy time.
Well, it's also an unusual enterprise. I mean, interrogation is something that's almost always a fairly solitary endeavor.
I'm going to stay with me. We're going to just take a short break here. We're talking tonight about military interrogations and the line between fair tactics and abuse. What do you think? Do you worry about the damage operations in Iraq have done to America's image? Do you have any questions for Chris Mackey about the personal effects of interrogation work? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. With intelligence playing a growing role in U.S. military actions, the role of interrogators is increasingly important. But as the Abu Ghraib scandal reveals, it's a hidden process with huge potential for abuse. Do you think the Army needs to better train interrogators, or do they need to do a better job screening candidates? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from France is Chris Mackey. He's a reservist who served as a sergeant and senior interrogator with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. His book is The Interrogators. Greg Miller, his co-author, joins us from Washington. He's the national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Chris, I want to make a point here in the program. Chris is not actually your name, is it? Chris Mackey is a pseudonym?
Chris is my name, but Mackey is a family name.
Okay. And a lot of pseudonyms for your fellow interrogators and indeed prisoners in Bagram. But there's a picture on the book jacket flap. Is that really you?
Well, that's me, yeah. The Army asked. The Army suggested, and in fact they required us to change all the names in the book. And we did. We followed what we went through a review process, and that was one of their requirements.
Are you concerned at all that you're easily identified in your photograph and perhaps a target for some of the things you've written?
Well, I'm not especially good looking, so I don't think anyone's going to be able to find me here on the metro.
Look at you shrugging this off. I'd like to bring callers into the conversation at this point. From Lexington, Kentucky, Andre is on the line. Andre, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
What's your comment or question for our guest?
Well, my comment is that it's ironic that, well, in the mid-80s, I was a Soviet prosecuting officer with Russian police in the former Soviet Union. And it was about the time when Ronald Reagan called us the evil empire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can tell you one little thing, that if we use the same methods of interrogation as like Monsterino or something worse that we saw in Abu Ghraib, I would be sitting in jail even in those times, you know. How can it happen here?
And in fact, some of the military police at Abu Ghraib, well, one at least is in prison, another six are facing courts martial.
Well, the point is that in our case, it would be found out about 5 days later after I did something like that.
Let me put that question to you, Chris. What do you think about the delays involved between when abuses and atrocities were first noted at Abu Ghraib and when something actually became public and came to be done about it?
I don't exactly know what the delay was, how many days it was or how many weeks or months. I think that if I understand that right from people who I know who were there, that the Army investigation began much sooner than it became public.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you can dispute whether or not the Army ought to have made it public sooner, but of course we know the catastrophic consequences that it had for the Army as it operationally in Iraq, and so you can almost understand why they didn't necessarily want it to become public. I would have liked to have seen swifter justice. We expected swifter justice when we were at the interrogation school. They certainly promised us if we had betrayed our oaths, and if we had betrayed the confidence of our commanders by breaking the rules, that justice would have been very, very swift.
Mm.
I would like to assure the caller that it appears that hopefully the Army will take care of business. I just hope that they get everybody in the net who was responsible.
An ever-widening net with each report that comes out. Back to the phones, another call from Lexington, Kentucky. This is Forrest. Forrest, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for taking my call.
What would you like to... Go ahead.
Yes. My question is, do any of the Middle East armies or countries train their soldiers in upholding the Geneva Convention, or is this some kind of standard that basically only, you know, Western armies uphold?
Greg Miller, do you want to address that?
Well, you know, I'm not exactly sure how many of the how many Middle Eastern countries are signatories to the Geneva Conventions. I think I remember reading that even Afghanistan was a signatory to the convention, although obviously by the time that the United States invasion happened, the Taliban government was definitely not a signatory. We get this question a lot. I mean, why should the U.S. sort of... The question comes down to why should the U.S. fight with one arm tied behind its back? I mean, why refrain from using very aggressive... coercive methods, if that might yield information that could save American lives or roll up terrorist cells elsewhere, and I think there are a number of reasons. I mean, I think I'd like to give Chris a chance to say so as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think it just sort of knocks you off the moral high ground during the early stages of the war in Afghanistan. Colin Powell appealed to the other senior officials in the Bush administrations, we have to abide by the Geneva Conventions. We do not need to give other countries excuses to mistreat our soldiers if they're caught. And the other is that I think the fundamental lesson of Abu Ghraib is those images are going to motivate and perhaps mint terrorists and anti-American sentiment for decades to come.
Yeah.
And the business of interrogation is about eliminating enemies, about rolling up cells, terrorist cells, and preventing or unraveling terrorist plots. It's not about creating more.
Chris Mackey, do you want to weigh in on this? The question originally was, is the playing field really level? You mentioned in the book that you found a sort of anti-interrogation manual with one of the prisoners that basically told them to be a lot more worried about what they might endure under some countries like Egypt or Jordan than what they might need to worry about from American prisons.
It did, but the manual that you're referring to, the resistance to interrogation manual that the Special Forces soldiers recovered and we translated, it still did provide remarkably clear insight into what America's interrogation methodology would be, and it proved that people who had taken the lesson from that manual and from the training camps where they received that instruction were able to do remarkably well, at least in the early stages against us. To further Greg's point, I mean that. Those guys who are the MPs and probably now some of the interrogators who have been cited in the most recent, the Fay report, I mean, they're called the six soldiers who lost the war. So the impact of us failing to observe the Geneva Conventions is just catastrophic. And when rear-line soldiers like intelligence soldiers or military police who guard prisoners betray their combat brothers who are out fighting and make their job that much more difficult, we all just have to shake our heads and just be mortified at the consequences. It's not what we're supposed to be doing.
We have another caller on the line from Coloma, Wisconsin. Will, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks a bunch. Hey, Sar Mackey, good job raising issues and helping the Army get better. I've got 2 points to make.
Mm-hmm.
The first one deals with the level of training that our intel analysts receive at Fort Huachuca. I'm an ex-infantry officer, combat veteran, and things I noticed, I've been on about 4 counterintelligence force protection surveys around the world, SOUTHCOM and CENTCOM AORs, and out of those 4, only one of them, I would say, was done to a professional standard. And these were all active duty intel analysts that I was working with, and it seems to me that Fort Huachuca is not, which is the Army Intel School,
mm-hmm.
is not preparing our soldiers to deal with the types of situations that Chris was exposed to. They focus a lot on enemy order of battle, which is the list of what types of equipment they're facing and, you know, enemy doctrine. and how to analyze Intel products and how to be part of a staff Intel process, but they don't really focus on how to gain Intel from sources. I don't think they do a good job with that. And I'll save my second point, let Chris address that one.
Chris?
I think that the training that I received at Fort Huachuca was a good foundation, but the best training that I had to do my job was actually at the British Interrogation School, where they have much more sort of practical anti-terrorism sort of operations other than war type oriented instruction, and I would agree with this gentleman that they could do a lot more to enhance the training in light of the current threat.
Mm-hmm. Will, you had a second point?
Yeah. The second point is just the issue of reciprocity. As an infantryman, we're always kind of concerned about the idea that if one of our soldiers is captured, or a sailor, an airman, regardless, how they're going to be treated. And the problem we're facing here now is we have crossed the line. And once you cross that line, you have almost created an acceptable process. So for the interrogator's perspective, when they're in, whether it's civilian, military, it doesn't matter, they need to realize what is going to happen to a military personnel when they're captured, or a civilian individual when they're captured, and how they are going to be treated. Mm. And we've opened the box here. And with that, I'll hang up and listen offline.
Thank you, Will. Will raises an interesting point there, but I wonder about the timeline when we're talking about beheading of hostages and prisoners, both military and civilian, whether the situation at Abu Ghraib could make the treatment of prisoners any worse than it already is.
Greg?
Yes,
well,
Greg.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's Chris will probably cringe just to hear me say this, but I think
ahead.
The irony is perhaps that those images from Abu Ghraib may, in the short run, actually help interrogation in the sense that it would that Al Qaeda manual that Chris was referring to a while ago was very condescending toward the American method. Mm-hmm. It said you have nothing to fear, basically, if you're in American custody. These guys are not going to lay a finger on you. And, in fact, the best thing you can do is try to provoke some sort of fight, because then you can potentially complain to the Red Cross and create an international incident or something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these images would suggest otherwise to potential captives. But I still think that, you're right, that you have journalists and contractors and others who are being beheaded and obviously horribly treated in captivity in Iraq and elsewhere right now. But that doesn't give the United States any free rein to pursue any tactics even headed in that direction whatsoever. I mean, mm-hmm. the United States has to stand for something if it's going to prevail in these wars and these conflicts and in this war on terrorism.
Chris Mackey, did you cringe at the thought that maybe in the short term this might toughen up America's image for future prisoners?
I don't want to come across as someone who doesn't wholeheartedly support the operations of the Army. I mean, the broader question of the war aside, anytime the Army is engaged, I want to see it win, and I hope for the best and highest outcome
mm-hmm.
for our soldiers. But I didn't quite cringe, but I would say that I'm in a small way pleased that the scrutiny exists. That the gentleman who called from Russia, expresses a point that how humiliating is it to be criticized by, and perhaps legitimately criticized by this guy,
mm-hmm.
by with his experience, and we're supposed to always be on the moral high ground. Maybe my opinions are naive, and I'm sure that Will, who called in, who's an infantry officer who's seen combat in on the front line, probably thinks that or people like him may think that we have to be more aggressive and that we have to support the soldiers in the field more when we have prisoners. But I just when I see what happened in Iraq, I cringe about that. I
mm-hmm.
cringe about the fact that that rear echelon soldiers are behaving this way when it's our job to help protect and defend and inform the people who are on the front lines doing the fighting.
I'd like to try and squeeze another caller in here before we take another break. Joe is calling from Spokane, Washington. Welcome to On Point, Joe.
thank you very much. Earlier today, I listened to a show where they had talked about doctors who had taken people who were unconscious and revived them so that they continued to be beaten or interrogated. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make me proud to be an American. In fact, it's shocking to me. I know we do it. And the other thing that really bothers me is we support terror. Uzbekistan, we gave them $500 million 6 months ago. They are a totalitarian dictatorship who abuses their own people. People disappear, are tortured, arrested, and just are gone. We gave them $500 million. We used to give Saddam money mm-hmm. when he was killing his own people.
Mm-hmm.
One of your guests said we need to stand for something. We do. We stand for terrorism, unfortunately. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Joe. Greg Miller, at the beginning of Joe's call there, the point that he makes that the doctors may have been involved in some of this ill treatment and military police and civilian interrogators, when we say we're talking about a few bad apples, is that even accurate when we're talking about people who come across disciplines in this? It seems broader than a few bad apples.
Well, I mean, I think that I think there's two things here. I think that the Fay report obviously dramatically expands the circle of blame and culpability here. There's nobody who can any longer seriously claim that this is just a few bad apples getting away with things on the night shift at Abu Ghraib. I mean, mm-hmm. there were policies in place that were fostering a corrupt environment at that prison. They were allowing the stripping of detainees and holding them naked in cells and in interrogations and things like that. And that's a dehumanizing, and I would think it's beyond what the Geneva Conventions would tolerate. I mean, so there is I think it is a systemic problem, and at least to that extent. I mean, in the same breath, I have to say that the Fay report also goes to lengths to look at all of these incidents. There's 44 incidents that the Fay report breaks down, and many of them, including all of them that, or almost all of them that we've seen the pictures of at Abu Ghraib, they'll say these prisoners, their abuse had nothing to do with intelligence collection, nothing to do with interrogation. In fact, many of these prisoners were never even questioned. They were punished for other reasons. So I think you still do have this bad apple problem, but it's on this sort of foundation of this corrupted system that was in place.
Chris, is it possible that I understand that you don't feel that you were faced with this, but is it possible that you as an interrogator could have been sitting across from a prisoner who had been abused in this way and not know it? Are you that removed from their life in detention when they're not with you?
Well, I know you're coming up for a break, so I'll be quick about this.
Oh, you're so radio savvy.
I didn't used to be. When prisoners come up from the general population cage and they move into the interrogation environment where they're being questioned, they become the property of the senior interrogator and the officer in charge and the military intelligence side for that brief time, or could be hours,
mm-hmm.
until they're released back to the military police. We don't really have that much interaction with the prisoners when they are in the general population, although sometimes we act as interpreters for them, for the MPs.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we assist doctors as they do their rounds because of our language skills. But if a prisoner didn't get abused in the custody of military intelligence, we might not know about it, although we certainly should. It's our job to be aware. It's our job to be cognizant, and our job to do due diligence.
Mm-hmm. But if they're not sitting in front of you with a broken nose and black circles under their eyes, it's hard for you to tell?
Right. I mean,
yeah.
We should know, and we should do our best to find out.
Okay. All right. Stay with us. We're discussing military interrogations and the Geneva Convention in the age of Abu Ghraib. Do Chris Mackey's stories surprise you, horrify you? Do you have more of a problem with physical torture than psychological games? Do you think it's fair to bend the rules when lives could be in danger in the war on terrorism? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about military interrogations and the line between fair tactics and abuse. Do you think it's fair to bend the rules when lives could be in danger in the war? What do you think of the increasing role of intelligence in military operations, and what checks and balances are appropriate for classified work? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me is Chris Mackey, who served as a sergeant and senior interrogator with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan after September 11th. He co-wrote the book The Interrogators with Greg Miller, national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Greg Miller joins us from Washington. Chris, I would like to quote you something from the book. You wrote towards the end, "We failed to break prisoners who I have no doubt knew of terrorist plots, or at least of terrorist cells that may one day do us harm." Talking there about the things you might have missed in your interrogation, how do you feel about that?
I recognize the fact that the reason why we missed it was probably because we were observing the rules as we interpreted them. We certainly went as far as I felt that we could go, and as far as the officers appointed above me felt that we could go without breaking the Geneva Conventions and the policies prescribed in the law of land warfare. But I also recognize that kind of restraint means that you're going to miss important information. I also recognize that although casualties were low in Afghanistan, we probably failed in our mission to supply the battlefield commander with enough information to make good decisions. I mean, I'm not trying to say that we were holier than thou in our efforts. We certainly tried to exploit every possible way that we could without breaking the rules to get prisoners to talk.
Well, it's hard to ask someone about something they might have missed, but how important information do you think you might have missed? I mean, are we talking about letting Osama bin Laden slip through our fingers?
I don't doubt that some of the people that we had have had information about that, and certainly people, as we shipped people back to the rear, and the rear in this case was in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of great friends. My reserve unit, which is the New England Reserve outfit, had people in both places, and later after I came back from serving overseas, we compared stories, and they told us that a lot of the people that we sent back, having only peeled back one layer of this onion, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Revealed other information that would have been much more useful had it been timely.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not especially proud of that.
Okay, I'd like to bring in another caller here. Gary is calling from Stoughton, Wisconsin. Gary, welcome to On Point.
Hi. I just wanted to make the point that I work in mental health field, and I do verbal and physical intervention training. And it seems to me when we go around and do training at places, people find it easier to berate or belittle individuals that they no longer see as human beings. And when we do our teaching and our training, we use terms such as detainees and property of, and we don't refer to people as human beings anymore. So it becomes more commonplace to mistreat them because they no longer have that face to them. They're an inanimate object. We train our staff to look at it as them versus us, and is it a win-loss situation instead of a I'm here to care for you situation and take care of you until our time is done together.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that somehow makes it easier for interrogations to go somehow wrong or dehumanized and easier for the abuse of prisoners?
I believe when we take away the human face of people, it becomes very easy to mistreat people. And going around the United States and working in prisons and doing training there, you find it all the time that, oh, it's them and them versus us, and if we don't do this, then they take the upper hand.
Okay, I'd like to put that to Chris there. The dehumanizing aspect, I mean, you write in the book about the blue jumpsuits and the number written on the front. Is that somehow a tactic?
I don't think it's certainly not a conscious tactic, at least not, maybe it is, but not one that I'm aware of.
Mm.
I will say that we eventually do get into the habit of calling prisoners by their number.
Mm-hmm.
Although of course interrogators have to be able to feign different emotions and possibly empathy, sympathy, encouragement, whatever, when you're actually confronting them, if that's what's called for. So you certainly we know their names when we're going in to speak with them, but when we're referring to them outside in an administrative thing, we never refer to them by their name. So that gentleman has a point.
Okay, back to the phones from Boston, Massachusetts. Dan, welcome to On Point.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Great. I was a battalion operations officer for a reserve MI unit in Iraq just back in March, and my comment is just about the sheer chaos of the detainee system. And I think listening to your guest there tonight, I came out of Fort Huachuca as well, both as a 96 Bravo intel analyst and as an officer, and the way they teach you interrogations in the schoolhouse is very orderly. We were in a situation where sheer numbers. We supported the 4th Infantry Division north and east of Baghdad, and their policy was if there was an ambush or IED explosion, they rolled up every male over 15 years old mm-hmm. in a one-kilometer area.
The wheat and, with the chaff, right.
Yeah, we could absolutely not keep up with that. And the other part, which was borne out in the Fay report, which I just read yesterday, was no one wanted to be the person who released the terrorists. So mm-hmm. we would make recommendations that these people had no intel value and recommended release, and the maneuver commanders would not would absolutely not let them go. And then send them up the interrogation system, up to the next level, eventually to Abu Ghraib, and just totally overwhelm the very limited human intelligence assets we have there.
Thank you for that, Dan. Greg, I'd like, we're starting to run out of time on our hour, so I'd like to give you a last comment here about the chaos that ensues when so many are brought for interrogation, and clearly some of them don't need to be there or shouldn't be there.
Well, I think if Chris would tell you just how difficult it is to keep tight supervision on the facilities that he was working in Afghanistan, including Kandahar and Bagram, where you had at most several hundred prisoners in custody at any point in time. At Abu Ghraib, as the Fay report documented yesterday, they had as much as 6,000 prisoners in custody, and that complex spanned, you know, acres. It was a chaos. It was a completely chaotic place, and the leaders there, including Lieutenant Colonel Steve Jordan, you know, comes across in the Fay report as somebody who was not suited for that sort of environment. He'd been out of the intelligence business for 10 years, and mm-hmm. headed over there for another assignment. Was diverted at the last minute to go down and run this interrogation facility there.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop it there. That's all the time we have for this discussion. But thank you both so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure to be on.
Chris Mackey served as a sergeant and senior interrogator with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan after September 11th. Greg Miller is the national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. They are co-authors of the book, The Interrogators. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the Iraqi soccer team comes up short in their quest for an Olympic medal. This is On Point. Iraq's Olympic soccer team lost to Italy 1-0 today in the bronze medal game in Athens. The loss ended a surprising Olympic run by the war-torn nation's squad. The team's coach, Adnan Hamad, said, "To reach the semifinal is a big achievement for our team under our circumstances, but we wanted to win the game and to have a bronze medal to bring happiness to our people." The Iraqis were hoping to win their nation's first medal in any sport since 1960. Thanasis Kambanis is Baghdad bureau chief for the Boston Globe, but right now he's covering the Olympics in Greece. I asked him how the spectators in Athens viewed the Iraqi soccer team's Olympic run.
Sounds like a cliche, but it's just the idea that it was a victory for them to be here at all. These were athletes who actually qualified to come to the Olympics, and most of the Iraqi delegation, I'm not sure if people are aware of this, come by special invitation. A lot of countries like Afghanistan, the Palestinian delegation, these are special guest invites that the Olympic Committee issues. The Iraqi soccer players, top of their game, beat teams including Saudi Arabia to get here, and that in itself made Iraqi people really excited.
Now, I understand in that preparation, even in playing some of those games, they faced some pretty unique challenges, challenges other teams would not have faced.
Well, I mean, for starters, they didn't have a home stadium, as in a home country, to play in. So they played all their home matches in Jordan. You know, that's a good 14-hour drive, maybe, from Baghdad to Amman. So that's where their home stadium is. They didn't have equipment. They had to find a new coach. You know, they were dealing with things that most professional soccer players are a rather pampered lot in the rest of the world, and these guys were dealing with things most of their colleagues don't.
I understand they even had to import their soccer balls from Germany, but then again, they're the only team that got a military airlift to the games.
That's true. but then you think about the player from Najaf, for example, who this week has been playing at the Olympics and simultaneously checking the news every day to see how much destruction has been wrought in his hometown. And I think that's a lot of anxiety for any of these any Olympic athlete to be under.
Indeed. Now, you're in a unique position. You're in Greece to see the Iraqi team there, and yet we usually find you in Baghdad for the Boston Globe. How do you think this has been perceived back home? I mean, we know that people were going all everywhere in the streets trying to find a TV to see them play, but what do you think it's meant for the people at home to have them compete?
Well, having been in touch with friends back in Baghdad, Iraqis who live there, everyone has followed this their performance in the tournament with, you know, bated breath. And frankly, there's a great feeling of national pride at work here, which is the, you know, something that Iraq is doing on the world stage that not only does it not need to be ashamed of, but that it can say, sort of stand up before everyone and say, look at how resilient we are, look at how we bounce back, and look at how we're as good or better than any other team. You know, a lot of folks tonight were taking loaded guns out in the hopes that the Iraq would win and they'd get the fire off rounds into the air. Maybe people have heard that the biggest celebration in Iraq, other than when Saddam was caught, was when Iraq beat Saudi Arabia. And it sounded like World War III had broken out there with everyone all over the city firing up clip after clip from their AK-47s in jubilation.
There's a bit of a cultural difference there. Speaking, though, of celebrations, there was something that was nipped in the bud quite quickly by the Iraqi team, an attempt here in the United States to use their presence at the games as sort of political fodder in a campaign for President George Bush's effort. And the soccer team stepped on that pretty quickly.
The players were fairly angry and felt pretty manipulated, as well as the coach. All of them came out and made statements saying that they certainly weren't where they were because of American help and that they loathed American policy. And I think the coach, when I talked to him, said pretty strong statements about, you know, America's destroying my country and we're certainly not here to help them.
Now, whatever the result of this last match, they're not going to be standing on the medal podium. They didn't stand on the medal podium today. They will not have the same kind of fears returning to Iraq that they used to when they didn't perform as well as maybe some had hoped. Can you give us a sense of what the old days were like for this team?
The reign of Uday Hussein over the Iraqi Olympic Committee was one that involved a lot of psychological and often actual physical torture. Athletes were given cars if they won, soccer team players specifically, given cars if they won, had their heads shaved if they lost. Some were locked in prison. Some actually were tortured. The higher stakes the match was that the team lost, the greater the punishment. I actually spoke with the former Iraqi soccer team doctor before I left Iraq, and he said that effect of that was they just never wanted to go very far. It was better to lose an early round match and come home and get your head shaved than to get to the finals and lose and come home and, you know, get maybe electrodes attached to you.
What a different return home they're going to have now.
You know, the thing about these guys is, you know, they're living in two weirdly, extremely different parallel universes. I mean, a lot of them are trying to get signed right now with European Professional League teams. At the same time, you know, everyone is viewing their mission here as distinctly political. And in fact, you know, in tonight's game, they played against Italy, and an Italian journalist who was killed in Iraq this week prompted the Italian team to wear black armbands.
Mm-hmm.
Before the game, the players made a show of friendship and hug and pose for pictures together. And, you know, you get the sense, and I got the sense of watching the games I watched too, that, you know, these guys can't get away from the politics of the country they're from. And you know, in addition to the weight they feel as competitors, they feel the weight to prove something about their country to the world. They feel an obligation to help cheer their country up. And then they're being, in a sense, asked to be responsible for the actions of whoever it was who killed our Italian colleague in Iraq.
That's a lot of weight just for a game. Thanasi, thank you for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Thanasi Kambanis is Baghdad bureau chief for the Boston Globe. He's covering the Olympics from Athens this month. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Rachel Dornhelm, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.